Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with the discussion of the Mahasakaludayi Sutta. This is discourse number 77 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's the greater discourse to Sakaludayan. And if you remember last week, we did the sections on the 8 liberations, 9 bases for transcendence, and the 10 kasinas, but I took them in reverse order, starting from the 10 kasinas, then going to the 8 bases for transcendence, then coming to the 8 liberations, the 8 vimokkha, but I didn't finish the 8 vimokkha. I know I left you stranded someplace between the 7th liberation and the 8th between the base of nothingness and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, so to advance from the base from the base of nothingness to the base of neither perception, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, the meditator has to consider that the base of nothingness, as elevated as it is still relatively coarse or gross, and that beyond this there is a higher attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, which is still more peaceful, still more equanimous, in which the equanimity is still more refined, and which is still more exalted or elevated in the development of samadhi. We have to remember that these are all, though they're called liberations, vimokkha, the word liberation here is not used in the sense of liberation from samsara or liberation from defilements. Maybe that is why in Pali and in Sanskrit, two different words are used to indicate the ultimate liberation and these liberations of mind. The ultimate liberation, the word is vimutti, and these liberations of mind, the word is vimokkha. So they're both based on the same root with the same prefix. But this isn't a very strict or rigid distinction, because sometimes the expression chaito vimutti is used, liberation of mind, to indicate states of samadhi, deep states of samadhi, which are not really liberation from defilements. And probably in verse, I haven't actually checked on this by doing a kind of search through the canon, but probably in verse you will find the word vimokkha used in a non-technical sense to indicate the state of ultimate liberation. But the 8 liberations are called liberations because they are temporary liberations of the mind from states of, we call them obstructive states, from mental impediments. Okay, so the meditator now considers the base of nothingness is relatively gross, and he make forms a strong aspiration and intention to reach the state beyond that, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And then he does this first by refining and mastering his attainment of the base of nothingness. Then what he does is to take as the object of his concentration the consciousness of the base of nothingness. And so it's a kind of bending back of the beam of awareness, the beam of consciousness, upon the consciousness in the base of nothingness. And so when the mind becomes fully absorbed in the awareness or in the focusing upon that consciousness in the base of nothingness, there arises the state of absorption or samadhi called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And this base of neither perception nor non-perception takes as its object the consciousness of the base of nothingness. And the attainment of the base of neither perception nor non-perception is designated in this way because in the state, the function of sanya, sanya is what is translated perception, has become so refined and so subtle that it's difficult even to say definitely that perception is present. And yet there is some perception there, and so one cannot say that it is a state of non-perception. Sometimes in the Visuddhimagga, a simile is used to to illustrate this. I'll give maybe a modern, updated version of the simile. It's like when you have a tube of toothpaste, and maybe you ask somebody who's going to the shop, and you say, "Please get me a tube of toothpaste. I don't have any more toothpaste." And then your friend goes to the shop, comes back, and you ask, "Did you get the toothpaste?" And friend says, "Oh no, I forgot to get it." And then the friend is upset, and you say, "Don't worry, there's still a little bit more toothpaste in my old tube. I'll manage to squeeze it out and use it for two or three more brushes." And so you could say when there's that little bit of toothpaste left in the tube, on the one hand you can say, you can't say that there's toothpaste in the tube, because looking at it from one angle you would say that there's no more toothpaste in the tube, yet looking at it from another angle you can't say definitely, completely, that there is absolutely no toothpaste left in the tube. There is just a little bit of toothpaste that can be used for a few more times of brushing the teeth if you squeeze it and roll up the base of the tube and then push out the top, you get a little bit of paste." And so with perception, all the other mental functions, feeling, volition, attention, all those mental functions, those mental activities have now been brought to a state of such thorough quiescence that one cannot say that they are present. And yet, they're like that little bit of toothpaste left in the tube. One can say that they're completely absent. If you really look thoroughly and deeply enough, you see, in fact, one knows that there is some perception going on because one is aware of that state, that there's some feeling. It's a very, very absolutely tranquil and refined feeling, completely peaceful feeling, but there is a feeling there. Okay, now this base of neither perception nor non-perception, that is, according to Buddhism, that is the absolutely highest point in the development of samadhi, purely as an exercise in samatha, that is, in quieting and stilling the mind. And if you remember the story about the Bodhisattva's quest for enlightenment, when he studied under the different teachers, the meditation masters of his time, under those teachers he mastered the base of nothingness, under one teacher the base of nothingness, then under the second teacher he mastered the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But he didn't remain satisfied with those attainments, but went out to seek a different path to enlightenment. Okay, so what comes next, the state called the cessation of perception and feeling. This is called Sanya Vedayita Nirodha in Pali. That is called here the eighth liberation. This is not just one more attainment along the scale of samadhi, but this is an attainment that is accessible only to the noble ones, to the Aryans. And according to the Visuddhimagga, the commentaries, it's accessible only to non-returners, anagamis, and arahants. Even stream enterer can't attain it. Even a once-returner can't attain it. And this cessation of perception and feeling, this is a state in which the faculties or functions of perception, feeling, and all the other mental activities have completely ceased, completely stopped. And the way this is attained, this again, it's according to the method of the commentaries. The suttas don't give very much information about it. That there's some information in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 43. No, I'm sorry, that is not the information for the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. That's another attainment. Okay, but for the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling, this has to be attained through the combination of samadhi and insight. And it can only be attained, as I said, by a non-returner and an arahant, and only by non-returners and arahants who have mastered the other eight attainments. That is the four jhanas and the four formless attainments. And so the way the attainment of cessation is reached, first the meditator enters into the first jhana. Then he emerges from it and he contemplates with insight, using the power of vipassana, to contemplate all the factors of the jhana as impermanent, dukkha, unsatisfactory, and anatta, non-self. Then he goes into the second jhana, stays in it for some time, comes out, again contemplates all the factors in that jhana as impermanent, dukkha, non-self. And so he goes in this way up through the base of nothingness, the seventh attainment. Then in the base of nothingness, he contemplates its factors, impermanent, unsatisfactory, non-self. Then he makes the decision that he is going to enter into the attainment of cessation. And he has to perform certain preliminary functions beforehand. He has to make a determination that if he's needed by the Sangha, that he will automatically come out of the attainment within that period. There are certain preliminary functions that have to be performed. Then he makes his determination to go for cessation. Okay, then the mind goes into the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Then it comes out of the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and then the stream of consciousness and all the mental functions stop. For the predetermined time, this was one of the mental functions, one of the preliminary functions, was to make the determination for the duration of the period during which he will remain in cessation. It could be a very short period, even a few minutes, or it could be up to 7 days. Okay, and then when that predetermined period comes to an end, then he will automatically come out from cessation, and then consciousness will arise again. In fact, now I remember where that discussion is. It's in sutta number 44. Yeah, it's in page 400, Chula Vedala Sutta, sutta number 44. It's really not very detailed. It starts actually on page 399. How does the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling come to be? And then it says, when the monk is attaining the cessation of perception, it does not occur to him, I shall attain it, I am attaining it, I have attained it. Of course, all of those are thoughts, but rather his mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads him to that state. That is, he has made the resolution, the determination to attain it, and through the force of that resolution, he attains it. Okay, so this is the eighth liberation, the attainment of cessation. And the Buddha says, now speaking about all the eight liberations together, that many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge in these eight liberations. Okay, now we go to section 11 on page 641. Maybe I should ask if there's any... I don't want to get off on any detours about the attainment of cessation, but if anybody has any questions, just anything unclear about it, please
ask. What is the value of that speech?
It's a good question. It seems to be considered, I can't say an extremely peaceful state because there's no experience of peace within that state, but it's a spiritually an extremely exalted state. Since it's attained mainly by arhants, one can't say that it has instrumental value for some higher attainment beyond it, that one uses it as a support for some higher attainment. But it's considered some, like the supreme peak in the scale of mental development in terms of, you could say, in the scale of the development of samadhis. Any other questions? Yeah.
Why would an arahant want to do that since he's liberated?
Another good question that I can't answer. But okay, arahants do enter, for example, into the jhanas. In fact, there is an answer to that question. The Buddha says, the question comes up, why would arahants enter into the jhanas since they're liberated? And the Buddha says it's a ditta dhamma sukha vihara. It's a pleasant abiding in this very life, a pleasant way to dwell in this very life. And similarly, all of the jhanas, the formless attainments, are also pleasant ways to dwell in this present life. And similarly, in the attainment of cessation, there's no feeling of pleasure, no feeling of the mind being happy. What it's like, it's inconceivable to me. But it's apparently it's considered to have some supreme value. And it's said that when a monk comes out of that state of cessation and then goes on alms round, then alms offerings that are given to him by lay people become extremely meritorious, much more meritorious than on ordinary occasions. So that is why some monks, in the time of the Buddha, out of compassion for lay people, they would just go momentarily into cessation before going on alms round. I think Venerable Mahakasapa, I think, used to do that. And then go on alms round to make the alms more meritorious. Okay, now we'll go back to the four jhanas in a way. After the attainment of cessation, this is like going from maybe a laboratory specializing in just like super high speed particle, you know, subatomic particle physics, you know, with these, what they call them, particle accelerators, investigating the properties of quarks and muons or whatever. Going to the four jhanas now was like going back to college physics. Okay, so in paragraph 25, we've gone through the jhanas at least by way of studying them many times. But again, I'll repeat. The Buddha says, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the four jhanas. And what's interesting is that even though the text does say that I have declared to my disciples the practice, practicing which my disciples develop or cultivate the four jhanas, one doesn't find in the Nikayas any kind of detailed instructions on how to attain the jhanas, which is something of a puzzle. But one finds, always one has these standard formulas, simply of the disciple going off into seclusion, abandoning the five hindrances, then it moves almost directly into the jhana formula, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. A monk enters and abides in the first jhana. But to get actual detailed instructions, one generally has to turn to the commentaries or works like the Visuddhimagga. And here one will find instructions like the development or practice of the kasinas, which I explained last week, or the instructions based on mindfulness of breathing, or based on the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes. So just taking a kasina object as a base for developing the jhanas, one will proceed using that kasina in the way I explained last week. First, one begins with the physical object, the kasina disc, until one is able to see that kasina's disc as clearly with one's eyes closed as one can with one's eyes open. And when one can do so, then it's said that one has acquired, or that one has gained the acquired sign, or the learning sign. And in trying to obtain the acquired sign, different obstacles will come up. This will be the obstacles presented by the five hindrances. And then one might have to leave aside the main meditation object, the kasina object, and use specific antidotes to these hindrances, to these obstacles. Especially the main obstacles that come up are sensual desire and ill will. Those are the gross obstacles. And so to overcome those, one generally has to use the thought or the reflection on the unattractive nature of the body to reduce sensual desire, and the meditation on loving kindness to overcome ill will, anger, resentment. Then the subtler hindrances will come up in the form of dullness or drowsiness, restlessness, or doubt. And those have their own specific hindrances, their own specific antidotes. The meditation on light, or sometimes is one antidote to dullness and drowsiness. A calming meditation object, like mindfulness of breathing, is one antidote to restlessness. And then reflection or examination of the text is an antidote to doubt. but returning to the main meditation object, the kasina disc, one proceeds till one gets the acquired sign, the ugaha nimitta, and then one works, leaving aside the physical object, the kasina mandala, the kasina disc. One works with the visualized kasina sign, the visualized image of the kasina, until there arises what is called the counterpart sign, the patibhaga nimitta. And the difference between the two is described quite nicely in the Visuddhimagga. It says the difference between the learning sign, what that's the acquired sign, and the counterpart sign is this. In the learning sign, any fault in the kasina is apparent. That is, when one uses the kasina disc, it has naturally some defects, different subtle variations in the color. If it's an earth kasina, there'll be some unevenness in the texture of the surface. And even though it's visualized very clearly, but it still is like an ordinary visualized, like an ordinary object that's seen with the eyes. But now the text continues, but the counterpart sign appears as if breaking out from the learning sign, and 100 times, 1,000 times more purified, like a looking glass disc drawn from its case, like a dish made of mother of pearl that has been well washed, like the disc of the moon coming out from behind a cloud, or like a flock of cranes against a thundercloud. Okay, when the counterpart sign arises, that does not indicate the attainment of jhana. That indicates the attainment of what is called the access concentration, the threshold to jhana. One is now approaching in the neighborhood of the jhanas. But with the attainment, the arising of the counterpart sign, the 5 hindrances are now dispersed and do not cross the mind, come into the mind. And the mind is now well concentrated on its object. But it's not yet in absorption, not yet in jhana. But one has to go on continuing to contemplate the counterpart sign over and over. And as one does so, one is strengthening 5 mental factors. These are the 5 factors of jhana. The 5 factors are what are translated here as applied thought, sustained thought, rapture or joy, and pleasure. Pleasure is pleasant feeling. And the 5th is one-pointedness of mind. One doesn't really develop rapture and pleasure. Those just accompany the process of development. But one develops the concentration by continuing to apply the mind to the object and keep it anchored there. That is applied thought and sustained thought. It's not thinking, the word thought is used, it's not thinking about the object. That's this is a problem of translation. But there are mental factors called vitakka and vichara. Vitakka applies the mind to the object. Vichara anchors the mind on the object. And one pointedness of mind is what keeps the mind bound to the object, unified on the object in an increasingly, say, narrower and narrower of focus. And as these five factors get strengthened, they eventually push the mind closer, sort of more and more deeply into the counterpart sign, until there comes a point where the mind gets full, you might say the mind gets enveloped or swallowed up in the counterpart sign, immersed in the counterpart sign. And that marks the attainment of jhana, the first jhana. Okay, now, after the attainment of the first jhana, the Buddha doesn't advise the meditator to go immediately and try to attain the second jhana. But rather, what one has to do is to gain mastery over the first jhana. If one tries to master, to get the second jhana without mastering the first jhana, that's like somebody who's trying to learn one language. Say he's learning French, he picks up a few sentences in French. Then he thinks, maybe I study German now. So then he starts trying to learn German. And without even getting a good knowledge of French, by trying to learn German, and then jumping after that to another language, he winds up knowing no language at all. So before one goes on to try to learn a second language, one first has to learn the first language. Or maybe a better example is like somebody who learns a little, say, high school physics, trying to go on to learn college physics without really mastering the high school physics. Okay, and to master the jhana, there are a number of criteria for mastery. I can mention five of them, five criteria of mastery. Mastery in entering the jhana, which means that one could enter the jhana whenever one wants without any obstruction, very easily. Then mastery in duration or extension, which means that one can remain in the jhana for as long as one wants. One could stay in it if one wants for an hour, and one will stay in the jhana for an hour. If one wants to stay in it for 2 hours, for 2 hours. Even if one is very good, then I don't think it's necessary to be able to get the ability to stay in the jhana for a whole day in order to go on to get the second jhana. But there are some meditators who do get that ability. But I'd say to go on to the second jhana, perhaps one would have to be able to easily sit in the first jhana for 2 or 3 hours. And then mastery in emergence or coming out from the jhana. That one comes out very easily with a clear mind, not sort of after coming out, one is wondering, where am I, what's been going on, but one comes out and the mind is immediately sharp and clear. And then the other two skills, one is called mastery and reviewing. That is, after one comes out from the jhana, one is able to review the process by which one sat down, entered the jhana, and remained in the jhana. And then the fifth is called mastery in adverting, which means that one can advert to the jhana and examine it and dissect it, analyze it into its different factors. One sees, especially one is able to see the jhana factors within that jhana. Okay, now to go on to the second jhana, the meditator will reflect and consider that this first jhana, which when he first attains, it's the most wonderful, stupendous experience he's ever had. It's the mind that's been elevated to like a whole new dimension of consciousness. Just pure, sheer, ecstatic bliss. But now he looks back on this sheer ecstatic bliss and considers that this blissful attainment is still defective because it's only the first jhana. And it has applied thought and sustained thought, vitakka and vichara, which are very gross factors. And he'll consider that beyond this, the Buddha speaks about another attainment, which is more excellent, more peaceful, more blissful, in which there is no applied thought, no sustained thought, in which the power of samadhi is even greater, more concentrated, more focused. And so again and again he considers the imperfections in the first jhana and develops a strong desire, an aspiration for the second jhana. This isn't the craving, but this is the chanda, the desire for the good. And then having developed that aspiration, he devotes the mind again to the meditation object, strengthening the power of his concentration. Okay, now when the factors of concentration gain sufficient strength, this is according to the method of the commentaries, this is what happens. He will go into access concentration, and then from access concentration, go immediately into the second jhana without passing through the first. But from a meditator who has spoken about his experience, who I'm quite sure is speaking from actual direct experience about the attainment of the jhanas, what he says happens is that when one's mental faculties get strengthened, one goes into access concentration, then one passes from access into the first jhana, and then from the first jhana, very quickly one goes into the second jhana. It's somewhat like running down along like a slippery hall and then one runs a certain distance and then stops, and what one has maybe very smooth shoes on with very smooth leather soles. So one runs a certain distance and then stops. And if one doesn't have enough momentum, one will slide a certain number of boxes in the hole that will take you only to this box that will be the first jhana. But if one gains enough momentum through running, then one will come through that first box of the first jhana and stop at the second box, which is the second jhana, because one has enough momentum to carry through. Okay, then once one gains the second jhana, one masters it in the same way. Then one considers that the second jhana, as excellent as it is still imperfect. Why is it imperfect? Because it has this factor of rapture, piti, rapture or joy. Of course, rapture and joy is what everybody wants, usually in everyday life. We want joy, excitement, rapture, ecstasy. But this rapture is connected with excitement, exhilaration. So it has, if you really look at it closely, it's somewhat disturbing to the mind. It's not really peaceful and quiet. And the meditator will reflect that beyond the second jhana, there is a third jhana in which there is no rapture, in which there is this pure pleasure, pure happiness, separated from all of the excitement, exhilaration, the tingling and bubbling of rapture. And so forming a desire, an aspiration for that state, again, he'll go back, work with the meditation object till his faculties get strengthened, till especially the faculty of concentration, till that gets strengthened. And then the mind will go into the third jhana. Okay, then, having attained the third jhana, mastered the third jhana, again, one applies the same process of reflecting on the deep, one masters the third jhana. Then one reflects on the defects in this third jhana. What could be defective in this state of pure pleasure, pure undisturbed happiness? Why is it unsatisfactory? I was waiting for that, but it's not, this is not yet applying insight to the jhanas. But when it's not considering it from that angle, when it's considering it purely from the standpoint of samadhi, concentration, why should the third jhana be imperfect? I can't quite. Oh, we left sense pleasures behind with the first jhana.
Because there's another one to be attained.
There's another one to be attained, but intrinsically, what is defective in the third jhana? You're on the right track. It does have equanimity.
But is it just that it's too gross? We have to get rid of all this rapture to feel good?
There's no rapture in the third jhana.
I'm sorry, the pleasure.
Right, yeah.
We have to remove that.
Yeah. There's equanimity in the third jhana. You see the description that the monk abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, he still feels pleasure with the body. But that pleasant feeling is, even though it's coexisting with equanimity, but the pleasant feeling is not the strongest support possible for that equanimity. It's somewhat pulling it in, it's pulling that equanimity or pulling the mind away from that equanimity, because there comes a liking for the pleasant feeling that's natural to form some attachment to the pleasant feeling. And so the type of feeling that gives the strongest support to equanimity is the feeling that is neither painful nor pleasant, the neutral feeling. And so one considers that this feeling of pleasure is defective in this way, and that beyond this is a fourth jhana, in which the equanimity becomes completely purified, completely balanced, in which mindfulness is utterly pure. And then when forming that aspiration, again, one does the work on the meditation object until when the faculties get strengthened, the mind will go into the fourth jhana. And then from the fourth jhana, one can go further into the four formless attainments. One does so, one goes from the fourth jhana to the base of infinite space by taking, I think I explained this last week, one takes the limited kusina object, that's the object of the jhana, one extends it, keeps on extending it, making it larger, larger and larger, until one extends it boundlessly. And then one mentally removes the kusina object, the boundless kusina object, until all that is left is the space covered by that object. And that is boundless space. And from there, one proceeds through the rest, the other formless attainments. Okay, any questions? Yes?
Are the first, are the early jhanas effort, filled with effort? Are they effortful because of the applied and sustained thought?
The first jhana. In the jhana, there is the mental factor of energy or effort, but the way one is experiencing it, it's not that in the jhana one is making an effort to keep the mind on the object. I would say that consciously it is experienced as effortless, but there is that factor of energy or effort which is present in that jhana through the accumulated force of the prior effort which has been invested in the process of attaining the jhana.
So the effort isn't experienced as being coarse?
Excuse me?
The effort isn't experienced as coarse as rapture maybe?
Well, all, say in the first jhana, all of the factors are relatively coarse, but one is taking the most prominent factors within the jhana are those that are called the jhana factors. And so those are the factors that the meditator takes specifically for reflection and consideration in the process of advancing from the lower jhana to the higher jhana. And so it's the work of vitakka and vichara, applied thought and sustained thought. Those are the factors that are most obvious as being the coarse factors. And so those are the two that he will attempt to eliminate by moving to the second jhana.
Why wouldn't these five factors be in the 37 days?
Why aren't the five jhana factors there? Three of them are actually there, but under different names. The jhana factors as a set don't come within the 37 aids to enlightenment, perhaps because anyway, it seems the jhana factors as a particular set are not mentioned that often in the suttas, and they come from, let us say, those passages which are giving a more psychological analysis of the jhanas. They're not mentioned so much in the things, specific things that one cultivates in order to reach an attainment. We do have the jhanas are included within the 37 aids to enlightenment under the right concentration factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. One of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path is right concentration, and that's explained as the four jhanas. But the jhana factors are not singled out, and one finds them mentioned as a set of jhana factors. Only in a few suttas, again, which, as I said, are sort of reflectively giving a psychological analysis of the jhanas, not so much describing what are the things to cultivate to attain the jhanas.
So I think applied thought, sustained thought would be very important.
Yeah, but they aren't mentioned.
In the third jhana, there's the abandoning of pleasure and pain,
yeah.
Previous disappearance of grief, of joy and grief.
Yeah.
Is that related to craving and aversion, pleasure and pain?
Not directly. Of course, pleasure and pain are respectively, you say, strong supports for the arising of pleasure, for the arising of craving, pain for the arising of aversion. But it's not really referring to that directly. But what is being shown here is that in the fourth jhana, all other feelings have been eliminated. And so in one treatment of feeling, feeling is analyzed into five types, not simply pleasure, pleasant, painful, and neutral, but there are five classes of feelings. The pleasant feeling is analyzed into pleasant bodily feeling, which is here called pleasure, and pleasant mental feeling, which is here called joy. Painful feeling is analyzed into painful bodily feeling, here called pain, and painful mental feeling, here called, it's not really grief, but you call it some degree of displeasure. Okay, in the fourth jhana, all of these four feelings are absent. Bodily pleasure, bodily pain, mental joy, mental grief, they are all absent. And what remains is only this feeling that is neither painful nor pleasant.
What would the body be? What would, in the fourth jhana, what would the body, how would the body feel? I mean, would it be light, or would it be solid, like have a solid feeling to it, or a very, you know?
It's said that in the jhanas, one doesn't actually feel the body itself. Because here the mind is just completely immersed in the state of the first jhana, rapturous bliss. First two jhanas, rapturous bliss. Third jhana, bliss without rapture. Fourth jhana, the state of pure equanimity. So that the sense of the body is absent within that, those states.
But can't you, you wouldn't necessarily have to be sitting to be in those states, would you?
Oh, one would have to be in a sitting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I think it perhaps is possible that those who have really achieved an extremely high degree of mastery over them might be able, while standing, to enter very quickly and come out in a split second. And of course, in lying down, perhaps one could enter into a jhana. But the case of standing, entering into the jhana momentarily, that is quite an exceptional case. But ordinarily, one would be in a sitting position.
What about with insight meditation? Combined with that, isn't that supposed to uproot everything so that you would still be in this jhana state along with the insight, the vipassana state, and that's supposed to be kind of your permanent, not permanent, but you're supposed to live in that state, aren't you?
When one is developing the insight meditation, one will not be in the jhana at that time. One can be developing the insight very soon after one emerges from the jhana, so that the insight is sort of suffused with the power of the jhana. But the insight, the mind, the way the mind is applied for developing insight requires the use of certain faculties, certain mental functions that are not operative within the jhana. The capacity for observation, analysis, attention to changing objects of perception. And that is absent within the jhana. In the jhana there is, you call it a solid state object of perception, unchanging, unfluctuating. One would have to come out from the jhana to do the work of insight. Any further questions? Okay, then we will stop for tonight. I thought that we would finish everything tonight. And now we still have all the abhinyas to go through. Okay, we will do the sharing of the merits.
Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam Akasata Chabumata Devanagamahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Devanagamahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata Cham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Sata Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya.